मज्ञानतिमिरन्धस्य ज्ञानं जनशलाकय चाक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः। नामश्रेष्ठं मनुमापि सच्चिपुत्रमत्रास्वरूपं रूपं तस्याग्रजमुरुपुरीं मथुरीं गोष्ठावतीं राधाकुन्दं गिरिवरं महोराधिकमधावसम् प्राप्तो यस्या प्रतीत्तगिरिपाया श्रीगुरुं तं नतोऽस्मि। वंशकल्पतरुभ्यश्च कृपासिन्धुभ्यैव च पतितानां पवनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः। निखिलाश्रुतिमौलिरत्नमालदिति निराजितापदपङ्कजन्त आजी मुक्तकुलैरुपश्यामनं परितस्त्वं हरिणं संश्रयामि। नारपितचरीं चिरात् करुणयावतीर्णाकलहं समार्पयितुमुन्नतोज्ज्वलरासं स्वभक्तिः श्रियं हरिपुरतसुन्दरद्युतिकदम्बसन्दीपिताम् सदा हृदये खन्दरे स्फुरतु वसचिनन्दनः। जानुलम्बिता भुजोकनकावदातु सङ्कीर्तनैकपितरो कमलायतक्षं विश्वम्बरोद्वियाभरो जुगधार्मपालु वन्दे जगत्प्रियकरो करुणावतारु। लादिनी शक्तिस्वरूपाय गौरङ्गसुहृदाय च भक्तशक्तिप्रदनाय गदाधर नमोऽस्तु ते। हे कृष्णकरुणासिन्धुदीनबन्धो जगत्पते गोपेशगोपीकाकान्तराधाकान्त नमोऽस्तु ते। राधे वृन्दवनादिशेखरुणामृतवाहिनि कृपया निजपादब्जादस्यन्मह्यं प्रदीयतम्। भक्त्या विहीनायपराधलक्षये क्षिप्तश्चाकमादितरङ्गमाध्ये कृपां मयि त्वं शरणं प्रपानं वृन्दे नमस्ते चरणारविन्दन् वृन्दे नमस्ते चरणारविन्दन्। श्री सच्चिदानंद गौर हरि की जय। श्री हरि नाम प्रभु की जय। गौर भक्तवृंद की जय। समवेद भक्तवृंद की जय। गौर प्रेमान हरि हरि बोल। वेलकम टू इच वन ऑफ यू। प्रणाम। थैंक यू सो मच फॉर जॉइनिंग अस टुडे फॉर सत्संग। द विलिंगनेस टू dive deep into the truth, with all that it entails, together, accompanying each other and trying to shed light to each other, within each other, without each other, and with the willingness to, and the need, hopefully, and the thirst, and the humility of acknowledging we are at all times confronting the infinite, right? So there is no limit to our progress. There is no end to how much can we honor and love and relate to the endless one. So that's humbling in itself. And that in itself creates a perpetual sacred longing. Both humility and longing, dainyam and laulyam. Two very important, not only words, right? But inner currency to keep in our luggage. Dainyam and laulyam, humility. Longing, humility, and longing. One should qualify the other. So hopefully here we are today to invoke those values, and at the end of our meeting we live a little bit more humble, a little bit more longing than a moment ago. So greetings from Ananda Ashram. And you are invited, those who would like to share anything today, as usual, invited to raise your digital hand and present any questions, any doubts, any inquiry, any topic you would like to bring today. For the conversation, for exploration, quest and exploration. So there are three raised hands. So we'll begin with Tatvadarshini, from Germany. And then we have Rasangi, and then we have Karuneshwari, and I have one question also sent by Pranada. So far we have four. Let's see. If there are any more, I generally encourage you to raise your hand in advance so I have an idea of how many questions will be per day, per session, so I can administer my time in trying to say something about it. Tatvadarshini, welcome.
Krishna Maharaj. I have a question which rose up actually my last week, a few days ago. My model left her body and I'm fe really fine. I was really praying a lot to Krishna and I really was feeling happy because I could feel like now she has a new chance because she was really trapped in her body and with her karma. And yeah. So, but then, because she was really not inclined at all regarding God or Krishna, not at all. And even when I asked her about how would you like to what should it be, your funeral and so on, and she told me, well, you speak all the time about death, and so she didn't like to talk about, and so she accepted a few times prasadam. And then I started thinking, it is said that a devotee in a family for a few generations above and ahead frees the people. And I was asking myself, what does this mean? I mean, I don't think she will become a devotee next life. I mean, you don't have to speak about my mother. It's just a general question. What does this mean, actually? So, I mean, I prayed for her. I hope she will become again in a human form, but I don't know. So that she might open her heart for Krishna, I was praying that she meets devotees. But I don't know if this is really the idea because there is a devotee in the family, or what does this mean?
Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you for your message, and of course, first of all, my condolences, our condolences for the passing of your mom and the transition in the journey. Of course, these are always threshold moments that for some reasons are to be honored accordingly in our tradition as well, no? All these different samskars that we have. In our particular tradition, different rituals or different sacred acknowledgments through ritual, through whatever, creating sacred time and space to create the samskar, to create an impression, lasting impression that may affect our journey positively. So, yeah, when someone is passing, is of course from the bigger picture, soul is eternal, nobody dies. We all know that lesson. In theory, but in practice, of course, still it's a moment of transition. It's a moment that will kind of affect the trajectory of the soul in one direction or another. And yeah, of course, it's a big test, not only test, not in any bad way. It's a big portal moment for the person that is transitioning, but for those who are witnessing the transition as well. Right? Not only how I deal with my own death, quote unquote death, again, the soul is eternal, but how do I deal with me witnessing other people's transition? That creates its own set of samskaras and impressions, right? So I'm going gradually to your actual question, right? So I think it's important to acknowledge this, to acknowledge that. Until and unless you are absolutely enlightened, so to say, you are clearly totally identify with the eternal being that you actually are, there is a place to know how to deal in those moments and know that in those moments there can be some crucial experiences that again could affect the trajectory of any one of us. So it's important to enter into those moments and those spaces in a prayerful way. For the other person, for ourselves, hoping that, yeah, moments like dying, again, when I use dying, I refer to leaving our body, help us to put in context our living, right? Because as we always talked, besides the living of one's body, you can use the word dying in so many degrees. The other day I was reading Srila Siddhar Maharaj, and of course he was very fond of quoting this line from Hegel, "Die to live," and speaking of surrender as a form of death, and then he will speak about there are degrees of dying, degrees of death, death, deep death, death, deeper death, deepest death. So in one sense, you can reframe the whole journey in terms of dying, in terms of a succession of endless deaths. And so my point with all this is we should be acquainted with the idea of dying. Of course, we should be clear about what's the actual thing that needs to die, what's the actual thing that never dies. But even when we say, okay, no, the soul never dies, I'm eternal. Yeah, great. But for you to realize that, you need to die to so many things. I mean, you need to die so many times, leaving your body, but you need to die to so many, we need to die to so many fears, assumptions, ideas, identifications, upadis. We need to die many times. And even when we speak about being on the other side, so to say, let's say you are fully participating in the Leela, in the spiritual realm, still you can continue to die to so many levels because you can continue to surrender and to give yourself even more and even more. And for that to take place, you need to die to your previous version of yourself. So death is a daily occurrence in Golok Vrindavan. Not that anyone dies, again, tragically, oh, Subal died. No, all of them are dying, but in the most genuine way. All of them are dying to a previous version of themselves to be upgraded to a new degree of dedication and depth. Every day, many times per second. So yeah, we should normalize the conversations about death. And for many of us, it all begins with dealing with death on a more body-related level, right? Because it may be too much for us just to talk about dying internally over and over again. It may be even paralyzing and scary. So first, we may need to know, how do I deal with the impending leaving of my own body, the impending leaving of everyone else's body, and living my life normalizing that, not in an insensitive and different way, being willing to sit with it, to confront it. Again, it's as the Mahabharata says, when Yudhishthira Maharaj was in this conversation with the lake boys, which was actually Yamaraj, and it's what's the most astonishing thing on this world? And he said, well, basically that everyone is dying, but nobody's behaving as if that's going on. Right? Or everyone officially acknowledges, yes, yeah, I know there is something called death, but I live as if that's not going to happen to me. Somehow I will become the exception to the rule. Or even if I know that's not the case, but let's try at least to live as if that's not going to happen. And again, the real problem is not leaving biological body. We have done that millions of times, and here still we are, not traumatized by that to some degree at least. But which are the false beliefs attached to that? No? Why we are, if we are afraid of death, which are the things, and I'm going to your question in a moment, which are the things in relation to which we are deriving a sense of identity, all of which will disappear when we leave this body, right? Many of us do not derive a sense of identity from who we actually are, but we derive a sense of identity from what we think it's ours, from what we think we own, from what we think we know, from what we think we do. And all that stuff will be dismantled in your last breath. So we need to prepare ourselves by living a life where we derive our self-identity from a real, actual source, which is who we actually are. So when the time comes to continue the journey, we don't even need to release anything because we were not clinging to that to begin with, right? It's like, okay, right? Some intense examples will be given in the Bhagavatam, but sometimes the example is given like you go to the bathroom and pass stool. Not to say things in this world as stool, but just like you're releasing that substance without further attachment, so to say. You are not even thinking, oh, I have to let go of this. No? So in the same way, but of course, if we realize still my identity is derived from things that at one point will not be, have not been with me and will not be with me, are just meeting with me temporarily for this in-between period called this lifetime, but have not been there before, will not be thereafter. Again, it's not that I have to be indifferent, but I just have to relate to that without the clinging. So death is a good word to bring to the conversation in that regard. So, going to your question, okay, if a devotee is there in a family, 7 generations before, 7 generations after, are we even here liberated? So no big pressure on you guys, right? The deliverance of 7 generations of ancestors and future progeny, whatever. It all depends on you. It's all on your shoulders. So no pressure, right? Because that can be presented in that way, right? Oh my gosh, the fate of my entire dynasties is depending on me. If we take a literal reading of that, we have been talking about in class, watch out for an extremely literal reading. First of all, the Bhagavan say if you're a devotee, but what idea has the Bhagavan in mind when the Bhagavan used the word devotee? Because there are so many devotees. There are so many degrees of being a devotee. We talked about this many times. Or chanting the name. You chant one name, you attain all perfection. Yes. What's that one name? What's that one name? Is the name that we chant all over again every day? Probably not. And because again, when the scriptures say chanting the name, the scriptures have a very idealistic notion in mind. Like the deepest possible idea of what's the name. That's the idea of the name that scripture will have in mind when it speaks about the name. Or like I mentioned in radical personalism, when Shastra speaks about guru, generally it takes for granted that the guru will be a bona fide guru, the deepest possible example of a guru. And on that foundation we'll say so many things. So in the same way, if we speak about a devotee, Bhagavatam is bearing in mind the highest possible type of devotee. We may not be that the type of devotee, and it's fine. I'm not it's there is not to make a whole thing of pressure, right? Like I have to deliver my parents by becoming a pure devotee. And even if you will be that highest type of devotee, I wouldn't say that you are delivering or sending by force to Goloka all these generations, because where's their free will then? I mean, if my mom doesn't want to become a Gaudiya Vaishnav, even if I become the topmost Gaudiya Vaishnav on earth, that won't send her to Goloka Vrindavan if she doesn't want to. Right? So for me, it's very important to deconstruct this notion of everyone has to become a devotee, everyone needs to be a Gaudiya Vaishnav, everyone needs to. If it didn't happen in this lifetime, okay, hopefully next lifetime they join Gaudiya Vaishnavism. Why? What makes us feel the need for that to be the case? Sometimes it's more about our weak faith than the universal compassion. It's more about I need everyone to be a Gaudiya Vaishnava, because if not, I'm almost the only one, and I'm not so sure if this is the correct path or whatever. So, but if my mom becomes a Gaudiya Vaishnava, if my father, the environment is validating my fragility. So if when we have a strong faith, we are okay with our own experience, undeniable experience and conviction and ideas. We don't need to convince anyone. And when you are in that unique place, probably many people will be very inspired by you. That's an interesting thing. The moment you stop thinking about convincing others, so many people becomes attracted to what you are doing in such an unassuming way. Because and when you are too much, or we are too much like obsessed with, may everyone become a Gaudiya Vaishnava. If it's not now, next lifetime, let's make it sure that they are going to Goloka Vrindavan by when their last breath, we throw them a gulab jamun at their mouth so they die with prasadam on the last moment, whatever, right? We try like to make this secure, these magical formulas, like if life works only mathematically. Again, like if the other person has no free will, it's violence for me. I'm jumping on the top of the other person's free will and trying to decide their eternal trajectory for them. Who I think I am, right? I mean, if I love someone, I will give freedom to that person. If I genuinely love someone, I'm giving you full freedom. And in your full freedom, you choose to do anything but what I'm choosing to do. I still love you. I mean, if I really love you, I will still love you. That's how Krishna relates to us, giving us free will. Trying to participate in relationship, but knowing that free will entails potential rejection of our connection to him for lifetimes after lifetimes, and still he's not leaving our connection. So when the scripture said a devotee liberates 7 generations before and after, again, if we take it literally in the grossest possible way, it means, okay, I joined the temple yesterday and now I'm a devotee, so my 7 generations of ancestor and 7 people after, they're all already sending Golok Vrindavan, even before they are born, because they are future generations, right? Which doesn't make any sense, right? Even they do not know about it, but I already send them there. Doesn't mean that. And again, that can create or a pressure or an unnecessary pride. I'm liberating everyone around me. It's more about acknowledging, of course, if you become a serious practitioner, that will have an effect of those 7 generations. It's like a way of saying what you do with your life, it's all about take responsibility for yourself. And the more you do that, that will have bigger and bigger repercussions. It's not just, okay, it's up to 7 generations and the 8th generation is not touched. Now, again, we enter into all this world of calculations and numbers, which is just to give an idea of how much, not to downplay any of this, of how much bhakti, if one embraces bhakti seriously, of course, that can have a ripple, a repercussion in so many directions. No, not to the point of canceling anyone's free will. Of course, not to the point of, no, this doesn't affect anyone. Yeah, it affects different people, people who are connected to you, etc. Not to the point of canceling their free will. So the more we become that lover of God, that lover of reality, naturally that will become contagious, and will affect ancestry, or whatever word you have for the ancestry up to the future, progeny. No, because still, it's not that those souls do not exist, right? Even if you want to speak about 7 generations ahead, it's not that all those souls will be created out of nothing at some point. No, those beings already exist in their own journey, and somehow, yeah, there will be a repercussion. But the point basically done for me will be, if you become, again, a serious devotee, it's proportional. The more you do that, the more your parents are benefited, your grandparents, though they are not here anymore, but again, they are somewhere and there is some tie with those personalities. And ahead as well. And your life in this particular lifetime is creating a momentum that also will ripple into future generations. So that's basically the point, right? The point is kind of a praise of the transformative power of bhakti, but not to the point that you are saving everyone, not to the point of taking the idea of being a devotee cheaply and just, I joined yesterday and everyone is liberated so far. You yourself are not liberated, so how can you liberate so many people? If we think, oh, I'm already a devotee, yeah, but how much of a devotee am I? No? Again, this all thing, all the things are nuanced. We have to leave the black and white thinking. Thinking, I was a non-devotee last week and now I'm a devotee. Really? I mean, I'm sure something happened from 1 week to the other. There's always changes, but it's not just definitive to that point. There are so many degrees of being a non-devotee, of being a devotee. So as uncomfortable as it may be to inhabit nuancedness, And we should try to stay there more and more. So yeah, that's, I mean, again, in your particular case, and I don't want to just limit this whole thing to your case, but of course, if you can have a positive effect on your mother, on your father, on your nearby, by what you're how you're living your life, again, not to the point of changing entirely their course and trajectory, but also acknowledging we affect each other, right? We exist in relationship. So how do I live my life naturally will touch other people's life that are close to me. It's like basic common sense. And if I live my life in an extraordinarily deep, beautiful way, that will have its own corresponding extraordinarily beautiful ripple and effect and overflowing in so many directions. That's, I would say, the main intention, so we don't get stuck with numbers and counting lifetimes and trying to save the whole world or whatever, right? At the end of the day, for me, it's a call to personal responsibility, not with neurosis, but owning our own journey, allowing the freedom of choice for everyone in their own journey, and trusting the journey itself. No? Even if someone we love, we feel they are choosing in a very wrong, harmful direction. At the end of the day, they are on a journey. It's not they will be there forever. And also, what do we know about where they are now? Again, especially in moments, in the transitional moment of dying, leaving the body. I mean, there are so many things that, especially if you study a little bit of these cases of near-death experience, so many people have very transformative moments in that short period, so to say. Of course, those who return are the ones who tell us. But those who do not return, still they go through something like that in one way or another. So we do not know. Someone may have lived a life in a certain way, or we may judge according to how you live your life, this is where you are going. But you may have a one moment threshold change, transformation, and that can affect your trajectory, and we may never know about it. So that's when we also are invited to release our expectations and our ideas about where everyone else is going and what's going on, trusting the unfolding of the journey, as it happened to us, with us. We may have been misled in so many different ways and directions and lifetimes, and here we are trying to be on track. We still lose track at times, but that's part of the journey as well. So, yeah, at the end of the day, it's releasing all that, trying not to control or calculate anyone's journey, trying to do our part in our journey without neurosis, but trying to own it, take responsibility, and trusting also the participation of divine love, unconditional grace, being very deeply instrumental in that. So don't know if that helps, Dr. Darshini, if there is anything else.
No, this definitely helps. I mean, I had good intentions, but your words were very enlightening and in a positive way humbling, because I realized, oh my God, yes, I was a little bit too much with my intentions to try to change something, but this is not love. And yeah, I realized what I have to learn, and thank you so much for this.
My pleasure. It was nothing, don't take it personal. It was not personal. I
No,
was
no, 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 no.
talking in general, and of course, each one of us, it will land according to where we are, right? Yeah. Thank you. Okay, before going to the next sharing, let's go for a few minutes to our breakout, breakthrough, break open, breakdown, break up, break left, break right rooms. And we'll be sharing in a small, intimate setting. Continuing to churn together whatever needs to be shared in regards to this particular thing we have been discussing so far. So, Dr. Russell will open the rooms now and see you in a few minutes. Welcome back. In case you are continuing to share, you're in a public room now. So, I hope you had a good sharing. Nutritious, broad, deep, touching. So we have a few more raised hands, but as I told you also, I have a question sent by Pranada. Actually, she sent that a few weeks ago. So if Rasangi allows me, I'd like to continue with that one, and then I go to your question, Rasangi. We will skip the breakout room after saying something regarding Pranada's question and go to Rasangi's question. So Pranada sent many questions in relation to one same topic. So I'll address first part of it, one section of it. Maybe we'll see if we have time for more later, so we can have time for everything and everyone. So she mentions the following. I recently heard someone speak about different types of gurus. Shravan guru is someone we listen to, as we do these days on YouTube. Siksha guru is someone we listen to but developed a relationship where we receive personal guidance. Diksha guru is who offers the mantra, and bhajan guru who will guide us in the esoteric practices of raga marg. I don't know that these distinctions are made in the Goswami books, but the delineation is interesting. Have you heard of this before? So basically, that's the question. First part. So yeah, I've heard about those before because those are delineated in the Goswami literature. Srila Jiva Goswami speaks about that in Bhakti Sandarbha. So you can check in the Anuchedas 206, 7, and 8. And there he speaks about mostly Shravan Guru, Bhajan Guru, Mantra Guru, or Diksha Guru. Now, an important point here is that not necessarily all of these departments are different people, right? They're often the same person. How many times? I mean, to speak about the Shravan Guru, someone from whom we hear, and Bhajan Guru, someone who guides our practice, but sometimes it's the same person, right? We are hearing from someone, and we are receiving like personal, practical advice regarding how to apply the knowledge in our specific case. Many times that happens from the same person, and that same person may be our diksha or mantra guru, the one who initiates us into the diksha mantras. So I'm saying this because if not, we think of, okay, Siksha guru is this, Shravan guru is that, and I know Siksha means instruction. So the Shravan guru, in one sense, is a Siksha guru. The Bhajan guru is a Siksha guru. And the Mantra guru is generally a Siksha guru. And as I mentioned, all of them are many times the same person. So Jiva Goswami speaks about that. Of course, as you mentioned, I'd like to mention a few things in connection to the question itself. Because you mentioned, for example, Shravan Guru is someone we'll listen to, and I agree. And you give a more contemporary example now, as we do these days on YouTube. And probably, yeah, we may think, okay, maybe Jiva Goswami needs to update the Sandarbhas in that section. And that makes the whole thing tricky, right? Because, how to say, generally, for me, at least personally, and I know there's nuance here, as with everything, and different opinions. But when we speak about someone being our guru, whatever of these categories I just mentioned, and in my thought, there should be some mutuality in the relationship, like some commitment, some connection. It's not that, although I just heard last weekend a 5-minute reel of you on YouTube, and I liked it, so I decided that you are my Shravan guru. It's like, oh, at least for me, it doesn't work that way. And I'm saying that because I have people writing to me and telling me that I'm their Siksha guru. Like, I didn't have a choice in the matter. They decided I'm their Siksha guru. And because what? Because they listened to a few lectures and they liked it. And it's okay. I don't want again to criticize that, but for me it takes more than just liking one lecture or two lectures. It takes getting to know each other. It's mutual. Again, it's not that I decide you are my teacher. But the teacher also can decide if the other person is a student, right? It has to be a free will cannot be canceled, right? As we were talking before. And for me, the key word here is mutuality. So again, with social media dynamics, the whole Shravan Guru thing becomes more tricky because I've seen devotees say, no, I listen to that devotee often. And again, I have nothing against that. That's helps you. It's great. Whether it is a Gaudiya Vaishnava, you may be hearing from other people. But sometimes we may, yeah, how to say, we may listen from a safe side of the fence, so to say. Right? So I listen, I like it, it nourishes me, it inspires. Great. Again, nothing against that. But at some point, ideally, if you are really inspired for the right reasons, you will feel called to commit yourself to that person somehow. Here I'm not talking about any toxic notions of surrender and losing your agency. Nobody's going there. But also I'm not going to the other extreme of just remaining from my sofa, so to say, consuming YouTube videos without entering into the complexity of developing a relationship with someone. As much as one can develop that relationship, of course, sometimes depending the case, it may not be that possible, but how hard have I tried, right? So for me, that's important. No? If I'm listening from someone and that person inspires me, naturally I will want to reciprocate in one way or another. And so I will be more interested in getting to know that person, relating, and if it's possible, again. Of course, sometimes you may be listening from some gurus or acharya who have left their body. And you may consider somehow, oh, that person is my Shravan guru. I listen from that person a lot. But in one sense, yeah, I may not be able to obtain specific personal advice according to my journey. And that's why sometimes this idea of bhajan guru is also mentioned. Because if not, we may end up in a place like Ritvikism. Which I don't want to sound like I'm like stigmatizing the Rigvedic idea, but in my opinion, that's not something, that's not a teaching from our lineage, right? That you can get initiated by someone who is no longer present, so to say, and how is the, where's the mutuality there? Of course, I'm not saying that you don't read the book of Pai Prabhupada or Srila Siddharamacharya, whomever. And you feel that you receive something from them. I'm not saying that that's not happening, but in your the specificity of your life journey, your case, your experiences, we need tailor-made advice. So we need someone close to us that may know us, and we may know them, and so that's connected to Bhajan Guru. And I clarify that because also you, Pranada, mentions in the question, Bhajan Guru is someone who guides us in the esoteric practices of Raga Marga. So, yes, but no, in the sense of, yes, in the sense that, well, our path is Raga Marga. So, yeah, Bhajan Guru will guide you in the Raga Marga because we are on the Raga Marga. I mean, that's our tradition, right? That's what Mahaprabhu came to establish. Prema rasa nirasa kurite ashwadam raga marga bhakti loke kurite pracharan. That's what was given to us, raga marga. Our sampradaya is not a Vaidhi marga sampradaya. We are not heading toward Vaikuntha, at least not most of us. So, in that sense, yeah, Bhajan Guru is someone who guides you in the raga marga. In the esoteric practices, I mean, everything is esoteric in one sense, right? How to chant the name properly, that's pretty esoteric, you know? Because sometimes we just relate esoteric to, I don't know, my guru is revealing me my spiritual body and telling, and that's esoteric. But no, esoteric is just the depth dimension of everything. So someone who guides you to find a depth dimension of everything, especially even in so-called ordinary moments and situations, that's esoteric. Esoteric has to do with secret knowledge, confidential knowledge. It's not limited to say, let's only talk about Manjari Bhav non-stop. It can be about discovering treasures when you thought there were no treasures, and I'm finding a new depth dimension in something apparently ordinary. Also, that's esoteric. So again, Bhajan Guru encompasses all this. No, it's not just someone who will be there to confirm my internal affinity to serve Sri Radha's and Manjari in this particular camp and mood when that's are coming inside of me at certain point of my journey. Only that's esoteric guide in the esoteric practice of Raga Marga. Also that, but not only that. That, I mean, Bhajan Guru begins from day one. From day one, we need someone, and it can be more than one person, who will guide us and accompany us, and like spiritual director, if you want to use a Christian term, so to say, no? Spiritual director, someone with whom I can consult, can reveal my mind, I can share my journey, and I know that person knows me. No, someone with whom I have no secrecy. No, let's put it that way. That's important to have people in your life that you know they know everything about me. I mean everything. Doesn't mean that you need to share your bank account and your email password with them. But yeah, everything in the substantial sense of the term is an important, relieving, revealing aspect to have people in our life with whom we can be fully transparent. And by us doing related to them from that place, we will know that what comes from them, if we trust them and we feel that they have insight to share with us, by them knowing us in detail, we will know, okay, whatever comes from them will be even more accurate. That probably something coming from someone who doesn't know me much. I may be advanced and maybe good in, have good intention, but doesn't know the all the details of my life. And sometimes I need someone who to address the thing more locally, so to say, right? And again, that person can be the same person who, from whom I'm hearing, a Shravan Guru, who is guiding me as a Siksha Guru, who gave me mantra, Diksha Guru, or it could be someone else. So one have only one Diksha Guru. That's what the tradition teaches, because the mantra is one. You receive it once, until or unless there was some complex situation with someone and you receive the mantra again, but it's the same mantra. But instruction can be multiple. Well, you can receive, I mean, not to say like, okay, you have 3,000 Siksha gurus and somehow you dilute the thing too much or the commitment too much. But there can be more than one, let's put it that way. That's said in the Bhagavatam. Nahi ekasmat guru orkinam sustiram set supushkalam brahmaitra dvitiyam bhai giyate bahuda rishibi. Right? The absolute Brahman, the ever-expanding reality, is infinite. So it cannot be addressed from a multiplicity of perspectives. And that's why the sages have said that you cannot obtain very deep, profound, fixed knowledge only from one guru. Interesting, right? I mean, you can have your one main guru, and that's great and beautiful. But again, if you have a great, beautiful relationship with that one guru, the fruit of that will be that gradually you will start to find gurus everywhere, right? Nourishment, inspiration in so many other directions, which will never diminish or dilute your special connection with that particular person, on the contrary. So those are some thoughts regarding this question of Pranada. And yeah, the main question was if I have heard about that before, so just going back one more time. Yeah, you can find that reference in Jiva Goswami's Bhaktisandarbha, the Anuchedas. I think it's 206, 7, and 8. Okay. Little bit more technical, but important considerations as well. Let's go to Rasangi, skipping this breakout room. And we invite Rasangi from California to unmute herself.
Thank you,
Welcome.
Maharaj. And I also want to say about letting yourself be known by someone else. Also, if you know if they can love you in spite of all your flaws, you feel loved. And that is so helpful too, right?
Yeah.
That's another benefit of letting yourself be known by somebody. Thank you. But I wanted to share something and then ask a question from the homework. From Bhagavatam class, okay? And then, but first I wanted to talk about another. My godbrother left his body, Charu Prabhu, and I've known him and watched him for 50 years. And I've said in a tribute, he was like the Energizer Bunny for Krishna. And not that, and he was so heartfelt, Maharaj. He was generous, kind. No judgmental, not judgmental. He had such enthusiasm. You know, I'm eclectic. I've been eclectic since Prabhupada left the planet, and I've been with different teachers, and he has never judged me or anyone for getting inspiration where they
find it. He appreciates and applauds that. And the outpouring of love for him is so phenomenal. Thousands and thousands of devotees are coming forward with heart-touching stories of how he affected their lives, how much love and acceptance he brought and helped them on their path spiritually. So I'm so happy to, have known him and be able to witness that. And sad that he's gone, but we need more of those examples of that non-sectarian. And he went to help Shamarani. Her group did a color fest there. And maybe people will criticize, oh, he did this festival of colors. What's that? Nobody did that before here. But he attracted 20,000 sometimes people chanting, dancing, taking prasadam weekend after weekend all over the world and teaching others how to do it. How can anybody criticize that? You know what I mean? So I'm just saying I'm offering him a tribute because people know him, maybe not, but such an example warms my heart. And yeah, what an example. And
Thank you for
my
sharing. Charu Prabhu Ki
and his wife also, and I know Bhadra knows them both and has that contact and inspiring people like touchstones, like that word touchstone. They would be around and get people fired up to do service all over the place. Anyway, my question is from the three ways of saying Bhagavatam. And we talked about it in our reading group yesterday, and we're still a little confused. And I just wanted to present my idea of something that I thought of in those three categories. It's short, but I wanted your commentary on it and maybe a little more understanding. Like I get confused between the allegorical and the esoteric a little bit still. So I wanted to see what you thought. And the example I came up with was Ardha Kukuti Nyaya. And Prabhupada used it a lot. It's not just, it's a very well known, you've talked about it, very well known concept and story. And the story about the half hen and the farmer who doesn't want the bother of the squawking of the hen or need to feed it. He just wants the egg that it lays, so I'm going to cut off that head. And then Prabhupada explains it as far as like the half head, cherry picking, like you said the other day, what you like, and the teachings, and the leaving the hard stuff or the more difficult things out. And then also not accepting Lord Nityananda, only Mahaprabhu. That's called half hen. He called that half hen philosophy too. And then also the concept of it being a lazy person's philosophy, somebody being lazy, lazy, lazy. And so, and then I was trying to think of the esoteric meaning there, and this is what came. I don't know if this is the right place to put that, but it kind of blew me away that, also, like in the world of like organizations or congregations, let's say spiritual groups, where you want everyone to work really, really hard, but when they ask for things or need stuff, you don't have any patience for them. They're a bother. I mean, that just came to me. It may sound crazy, but it's true. Like I've heard it over and over again. People were going and working hard and producing, collecting, doing things. But then when they had their needs or desires, that wasn't considered. And that is like half hen. Because if you can't nourish people and give them your time and attention, how can you maintain full relationships? And then everything falls apart. And that's what Prabhupada said too. Yeah, eventually things fall apart because They're not tending to the necessity. So I don't know if that's esoteric or allegorical. It's, did I screw something out of there that's not really esoteric? It seemed deeper and it hasn't mentioned anywhere. So I thought it may be esoteric.
I'm not so sure if I understood your question, to be honest. Sorry. I'm not so sure, to be honest. I mean, I've spoken about the half-can logic, of course, but I don't understand how that relates to esoteric.
Well,
And
what
to
is
the
the S?
example of take, I mean, I get how trying to engage people in something but then not caring for them is a form of half-can logic. I
Yeah.
get that. But the connection with the esoteric, I got lost there.
So that's not esoteric. That's more, there's something there, but it's not necessarily the esoteric meaning of that story. Is that what you're saying? So, what would be the esoteric meaning of that story? I'm trying to understand the concept of what's esoteric and what's allegorical.
Well, maybe you need to listen to the whole lecture again or something. I gave 2 hours of
I
that.
know, I listened, and I've done some research. Others
Yeah.
didn't totally get it either, Maharaj. We're just, this is a new way of viewing, if
Mean,
just
I won't
the
say it's a new way of viewing. That's already there always. And we are just articulating that with certain words, but I'm not the only one talking about it, not the first one. But yeah, I mean, what I get is that, of course, and we were talking about that with Bhaktarasa the other day, that of course we were talking about these three levels of reading the Bhagavatam, and but also the Bhagavatam is, it's a lot, it's not limited to the book Bhagavatam, right? As we already tried to explain. And the ultimately Bhagavatam is the love story of God and everything. And that's life at the end of the day. That's what life is. So in one sense, the approach to the Bhagavatam, okay, can be applied to the approach to life, right? So maybe I approach life in a very literal way, in a more interpretive or allegorical way, or a more
I see.
esoteric way. So then I'm trying to connect with what you are saying. Okay, you gave the example of a life situation with this people serving in a community. Okay, how to take that literally or interpretively? Again, we cannot make maybe full parallels on everything, but because half-hand logic is one thing that I mentioned in one context, right? Like, okay, you cannot take scriptural statements and just pick whatever you want and discard the other thing. Great, that's more related to the, in terms of reading scripture, that's more related to the allegorical reading, so to say. The literal may be more taking something but not being able to see that in context, and then whole mess. And we can do that with people also, right? We can put them, take it something from the person, what we like the most, what is more convenient for us, as you said. And when that person needs something, when then that situation invites us to see a bigger picture, we don't want to see that. We just want our beginners mind reading of the person even. So that's like, yeah, half-hand logic. If we want to apply this framework of literal, interpretive and esoteric to a situation like that, yeah, we could say, okay, literal reading will be, yeah, a very gross external reading of the person, very decontextualized, many times very, as you say, very self-centered, like as I read scripture according to my own interest, as I say, you know, I read scripture according to my own emotions. Okay, I will see another person according to my own convenience, just to make some type of connection between the two. As I read the scripture, being a bigger picture, putting everything into context, okay, I allow the person to not only to see the person in a utilitarian way, like, okay, what can I derive from you, but what do you need? No? And if you want to use this esoteric framework that I explained to scripture, apply to that particular example, and again, I'm making some effort to create something about that. Yeah, we could see that person. Well, that person is not only a human being with some needs that I need to be sensitive with, but on top of that is a soul that is loved by Krishna. Let's put it that way. Now let's bring even an even deeper picture, you know, and who has a beautiful potential in bhakti, and I'm there to serve that soul and that potential in bhakti. Not only human needs, of course, but also someone that. It's someone who is infinitely loved by the person I'm trying to love. I'm trying to love the divine. The divine is loving that particular person infinitely. So my paying attention to that person, is a way of not only in a way that, okay, I will help you because Krishna will like me more if I help you. Not from that calculated place, but from a real, genuine place of I want to love Krishna, but I want to love everything else because, again, everything else is loved by Krishna and connected to Krishna. So I'm invited to love everything and everyone. If we want to use that example and this term of esoteric, which again, as I explained that in my class related to the Bhagavatam is slightly different, and we are talking about lila and participation in lila and reading a scripture in a way that is experiential. But of course, again, as I say, the Bhagavatam is not only a book, you ultimately we're invited to relate to life from that place. So you ultimately life is lila. Jiva Goswami uses the term Srishti lila. Now the lila, we are in the lila of creation here. So it's also lila. Now lila is not only going on the other side of the rainbow, so to say, in Golok Vrindavan. This also is a type of lila. Divine sacred play in which the sweet absolute is involved. So how do I learn the rules of the game to participate in Lila, which have to do how do I relate with everyone? So that grew. Oh, sorry, I bit my tongue. I suppose that's part of the Srishti Lila. So yeah, how to take responsibility, right? No victim consciousness, no Krishna's arrangement, right? No Krishna's plan. It was not even intentional from my side, but it just happened. That's a good example of things that happen in life. So,
Thank you.
Srishti Lila. So that will be another way of seeing the whole thing in an esoteric way, right? Not only, okay, I want to get benefit from this guy contributing to the community. Not only, okay, he also is a human being who has needs. I will pay attention to that. But ultimately, this is all part of Lila.
Wow.
This is
Because
all a
Maharaj.
way of participating in a divine sacred play by relating to each other with Krishna in between. I'm bearing in keeping in mind how loved each other is by the divine and our potential in love. So that's an even deeper and bigger framework. I've tried my best. I don't know if that helps.
That was helpful, Maharaj, but you in did invite us. You did
Sorry,
invite
what?
us. You invited us, I think, to try to see things esoterically, although it's for the higher souls generally. But you want us to try, right? To see things esoterically too?
I mean, if you want to try, you try. It's not that I'm here wanting you to do. I just bit my tongue. That's who I am. Right. So I
Need some water. I'm sorry.
have it. I have it here.
I don't see any blood. I'm so sorry that you did
Yeah.
that.
It's all voluntary, right? So it's not so much Maharaj Padmanabha wants us to do that, and
Well,
therefore we should be doing that. I mean, if you want that. It's great. That's great.
but you
But
were
it's
also warning us to. We don't jump there. I mean, I was listening. I listened.
yeah. The esoteric reading, as we mentioned, is not something that you just can be there immediately, right? And even you can make an intellectual effort to try to interpret something esoterically, but the deeper level of esoteric reading of reality, you are not making even any effort to read anything. You are there. You are experiencing that. Without any need to think about it. So there are degrees of each one of these three levels. Again, I spoke about these three levels like a general way of just bringing three categories, but you can bring endless in-between categories. Like we say, Kanishtha, Madhyam, Uttam, and I related those three with these three categories. But also sometimes we hear there are Kanishtha, Kanishtha, Madhyam Kanishta, Uttam Kanishta, and the same, right? Madhyam Kanishta, Madhyam, 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 Uttam Kanishta, Uttam Madhyam, Uttam. Okay, now we have nine. Okay, but it's not that only we have nine either, right? It's just ways of speaking about certain stages, but each moment, each step, each breath is a new stage on the journey. So the same with this literal, allegorical, esoteric. It's like endless nuance in between, right? But we need some wording and some compartmentalizing to just at least to start to conceive some that there are different ways or different degrees of depth to do things, and it's not just one thing. But from there, we have to continue playing out the implications of that and realize it is endless. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. That was
Oh,
helpful.
thank you.
Thank you.
So I'm sending you to the breakout rooms so I heal my tongue now. And I'm joking. I don't want to concern you. It was not that strong. If not, I couldn't have been able even to talk to you after
Some
that.
ice.
I can do the Albert Einstein mudra for you to see that I'm doing fine. So I don't take myself too seriously. That's a humbling necessity as well. Okay, see you in a few minutes back. Please join if you want, if you can, the breakout rooms, and let's continue churning this ocean together. Pranam, welcome back. Hope you had a good private room with your brothers and sisters that correspond to this particular meeting this time. And let's continue. I've seen that we had Karuneshwari raising her hand, and I saw also Divyangana raising her hand as well. So let's go to Karuneshwari. You can unmute yourself. Welcome.
Thank you. Hi, Krishna. My question came from something I read today by a devotee. He was talking about how so many devotees who have made their vows have struggled to keep up those vows, especially like within ISKCON, the four regulative principles and the 16 rounds. And it just got me thinking that it seems like this interesting paradox that at the same time that such an amazing event happened, that this Krishna conscious and Lord Chaitanya's movement, that this spread around the world more than ever before, it's a great happening. At the same time, a set of rules and regulations came with it that proved to be very difficult for, you could say, a lot of devotees, or you could maybe even say most, to follow. I was thinking it's a bit of a paradox that these two things happened simultaneously, and I was thinking, like, by what arrangement did it come like that? That some amazing mercy and wonderful availability of such knowledge and process, and then this almost like in some ways crippling for a lot of people. So I wondered if you could say something about that. I look forward to hearing what you might say about that.
Okay, that's one of the say something about that questions.
It's not a how do we question, is what
Okay,
it's
yeah, those are the top two, I will say, the how do we and say something about that, which is totally fine. Different rasas in the menu, different spice in the masala. All are welcome. Everything belongs. Yeah, that's a paradox, right? Interesting. And it's a complex combination, right? Because in one sense, if you have something being spread, but spread in a way that eventually, and again, I'm not pointing at ISKCON or at any particular group, just as at the situation as a religious phenomenon, besides even Gaudiya Vaishnavism, it can happen anywhere. It has happened in other places as well, just in case we are not the first ones having problems with vows and rules, and we are not the first ones spreading the message, so to say. But yeah, what I'm thinking is like if something becomes very, in one sense, something becomes very available, but at the same time becomes very unavailable. If the commitments are presented in a very rigid and exclusivistic way. So it's indeed not only paradoxical, but I will say contradictory, right? because I'm spreading something in a very broad way and generous way, but then at the same time restricting the possibility of being part of that to a certain way of doing it. And if it's not like that, sorry. Which I don't think that's how Mahaprabhu began the movement, to be honest. He was just singing and dancing and crying, and Nityananda Prabhu, as was reading the other day, one song by Lord Chandrasekhar Thakur, and how he, being the original guru, right, for us as for the gurus to get an example from him, he was just knocking on the door and crying and rolling on the ground, and he was like covered by dust and imploring everyone to chant the name of Gauranga with such humility, such dedication. If you just do that, I sell myself to you, I belong to you. That's how it began, right? He didn't say, you have to follow these principles and chant this number of things, and you have to do that and promise to never leave this institution. There was no contract of such sort. And I'm not criticizing that, just in case. No, I'm not saying like those who ask the disciple to commit to vows are wrong. I'm not saying that either. I mean, vows are not a bad word. I mean, they are there in scripture. They are there in every tradition. But in my opinion, and I don't think it's my opinion only, is that vows should be adopted according to one's capacity. And one situation, you cannot give a set of vows, the same vows to everyone, because not everyone is in the same situation. That's as simple as that. And remember, Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur, when he's describing Anushthita Bhajana Kriya or unstable bhakti in his Madhurya Kadambini, he subdivides that lack of stability, that stage of the journey, which is before reaching Nishtha, which I will say most of the members of the Gaudiya community have not achieved Nishtha in general, not to stigmatize, just like to normalize. Nishtha is not such a cheap thing. So he will describe one of the six symptoms that characterize most of the people in our communities, niyama akshama, which means you will have difficulties in keeping your vows. So he's mentioning that to normalize that. So if that will be such a normal thing for the majority, if you make that following of vows so rigid and strict, you will have the majority going crazy and neurotic and being discouraged. Rather than saying, oh, Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur hundreds of years ago already normalized that most of us will have difficulty with our vows, not to just make it, okay, let's fail as much as we can in our vows. Nobody's saying that. But just to normalize, that's probably what will be happening to almost all of us at certain type of the time of the journey. And that should be also normalized, and and the vows should be adjusted to one situation in that journey, rather than keeping a rigid standard universally applicable to everyone at every moment. That's problematic in the double way. First, when you cannot follow the standard and you feel again miserable, you feel useless, you feel bad, you feel you do not belong, you feel an outsider, a betrayer, you start to lie, to fake it till you make it, you start to perform. Long list of problems when you cannot follow those vows. I mean, there are many problems. Second problem, if you can follow the vows, you think that you're already in and you don't need to do anything else because you are following the vows. Like if following the vows are the all in all. And the extension of that problem is that going back to literal, allegorical, and esoteric reading, many people read these vows in a very literal way, very unnuanced way. You have to chant 16 rounds. No, you have to chant Sudanam. 16 rounds of Nama Parat? No, thank you. It's not about 16 rounds. I mean, you can chant one half a syllable of Shuddhanam, and probably that has more weight than 16 rounds of Nama Parat. It's all quality, it's not quantity. And if I'm chanting Nama Parat and I keep getting neurotic about the number, I will continue chanting even more Namapurat. So it's not that the more Namapurat, the better. And at one point, you multiply the Namapurat and suddenly you're chanting Sudanam by increasing the number of Namapurat. It's like, no, you didn't learn the math properly. So chant in quantity, that's what I will say. And again, I'm not here replacing anyone's vows, because you, each one of us, accepted their vows as a conscious, mature human being to some degree. So we have to take responsibility also with, I mean, we were not 4 years old, I don't think so. We're all relatively adults. And even if we were not an adult, then you'd realize, oh my gosh, yeah, I committed to something at that time. I was naive, I was daydreaming, I was tripping on my honeymoon period. Okay, it's totally fine. But still, you may need to adjust that or whatever. But we have to take responsibility, no? And in that responsibility, part of the responsibility is taking responsibility doesn't mean continue your vow even if you cannot follow and feel guilty because you accepted the vow. No, taking responsibility is thinking for yourself, okay, what do I need to do? How to make this whole thing sustainable? Do I need to adjust my vows? Okay, I have to talk to my guru. I have to whomever I accepted those vows. My guru is no longer there. Okay, how to readjust my situation of commitment so I don't go crazy? Because in the name of following vows, you don't want to end up in a madhouse. I mean, that's not the idea. That's not at the end of your life. It's like, I was able to keep all of my vows. I'm totally dysfunctional as a human being, but I never failed one day with the nam. And Krishna will be like, who said that was the fruit? I don't want to see you miserable and dysfunctional and crazy. I mean, it's common sense. And as I say, we read these vows very literally. Do not eat meat. That's not the vow. Vow is ahimsa. Say, mentioning radical personalism, non-violence. Still, the vow is not violence. It's not violence. That's still negative. It's be kind, and that's still not the vow. Be as kind as you can. That's the vow. Be as kind, loving, and compassionate as you can. That's a vow, and that's a way more difficult vow than just being vegetarian. So probably you're breaking that vow all day long. Not to feel bad about it, just to realize, oh, this is deep. This is profound. No, I'm trying. No, try to sincerely be as kind as you can on a daily basis. That's the vow. Not be vegetarian. Not do. No, it's try to be as loving. Try to. Oh, each one of these vows. And again, this is framed in a particular society, as we talked many times. In other Gaudiya Vaishnava societies, nobody's asked to commit themselves to these four pillars of dharmas described in the Bhagavatam. They are in the Bhagavatam. I'm not saying this is invented out of nothing or this is wrong. I mean, these are very beautiful virtues, right? Compassion, kindness, austerity, which means also introspection, right? No, not don't think about that in lacking as lacking or repression, purity, truthfulness. Again, truthfulness. That doesn't mean don't go to the local casino. Because we think, oh, that's not gambling. No, the principle is satyam, truthfulness. And there is no end to how truthful we can be. So for me, the whole problem begins when we have a very limited conception of what even the vows are about. So wrong sambandha, there will be wrong avideya and wrong prayojan. Dysfunctional practice, bitter fruits. So we have to reconfigure what are these vows, how broad, how deep they are. Okay, I get it. Okay, there are so many depths and layers to embrace these vows of truthfulness, of purity, of compassion. There's no end to how much we can practice all those things. So we can always attain a new level of those vows. But it's on a daily basis, in a sustainable way, in terms of the number of chanting. That ideally, in my opinion, should be prescribed according to one's situation. And if one committed to something at one point, for whatever reason you cannot sustain that, you should be able to adjust. We should have adjustable vows. No? Bow is the purpose of the bow is not that I never broke the bow. Again, Bhishma Chakravarti Thakur say, you guys will almost of you all of most all of you will break them at one point. Like normalizing that. So adjustable bows, which doesn't mean be lazy, be escapist, be like complacent, do not commit. Just be realistic and be radically personal to where you are right now. And a bow that super helped you may not be helping you now. And you may need a new commitment or a new form of the same commitment, a new crafting of the same commitment. That's why, again, going back to Bhajan Guru, that's why we need guides in our life that we can talk to personally and they know us and our situation. And if not, we will be thrown just generic vows. And our situation is very specific and needs some tailored made considerations. And if for whatever reason some of those guides are not cannot be there, then we have to resort to some other people or to our own criterion to adjust that in a way that is sustainable. Smarta vyasa tatam Vishnur Bhishmarta vyanajatu chit sadur sarva bidini sedasyur. For me, the whole bow conversations summarized in that verse. Always remember Krishna, never forget Krishna. All rules and regulations are to serve those principles. Bas. If my way of following my rules and numbers and vows are making me miserable and more absent from my connection with the divine, they are not fulfilling their purpose. It's not that the vows are wrong. Probably it's just that I'm approaching the vows in a wrong way. Rupa Goswami says that in Upadeshamrita, verse 4, Niyama Graha. To follow all this Yama Niyama, these do's and don'ts, without knowing why you are doing that. Just mechanically, just because everyone else is doing, just because you are supposed to do it, just to belong, to fit in. And I can understand the deep necessity of every soul to find an identity. Three words came yesterday to me, which we are all desperate for. With good sense, identity, purpose, and belonging, right? The three are interconnected, of course. Identity, purpose, and belonging. We cannot live without that. And sometimes we are willing to do anything and everything to get that, even to get a fake facade of that. And we end up compromising everything, unfortunately, for the sake of give me an identity, give me a sense of belonging. Give me some purpose. And we may end up, again, following rules in ways that are not realistic, are not sustainable. Again, in the beginning, we were receiving an identity and a sense of purpose and a sense of belonging. So we were okay with, yeah, I will do everything. I will follow this. But again, it came from a very genuine place. I'm not condemning any of that. But in time, we realized, oh, it's not sustainable. I still want identity, purpose, and belonging, but the way how to follow my vows in a way that my following of vows or commitment, my commitment to the ideal at the end of the day, facilitates that sense of identity, purpose, and belonging. Because at the end of this, we are committed to an ideal, embodied in sometimes in people, in communities, but at the end of the day, we are there for the ideal. And we may need to take different stances to fulfill that. So yeah, I agree with your concern, Karuneshwari, that and sometimes how to say that something is spread in a very big way in quantity doesn't necessarily mean that there is quality. And I'm not pointing here at ISKCON or at anything. It's just what it is in general. Because in order for it to be quality, you have to spend specific time with every specific person and work on every specific case. And for that, you cannot spread that in such a big way because it takes time to be with every person, adjusting the bows of every person, so to say, right? So that's the price. And if we don't do that, okay, we may be doing something very broad, which again, I have nothing against it, but since we cannot get too specific with every single case, we end up having a more simplistic template, one size fits all, which works like as an entry point again in the honeymoon and in the first period of everyone looking for purpose, belonging, and identity. And we can have numbers and millions, but the thing is, after some time, what's going on with them? How that people is sustained and nourished? And we have seen that many join, but many leave. And that's not the purpose. The idea is not like just, well, at least we have always someone coming through the door. No. The idea is, Srila Prabhupada say that. He was a lot about sharing the message, but he said, if I have to choose, I prefer one devotee that remains as a devotee than a new devotee. So I don't want new devotees that eventually become non-devotees, so to say. But still we have new devotees coming, which are future non-devotees. Right? You follow my point? So that's my policy, so to say. I know that some people, yeah, rotating door. Thank you, Trivikram Prabhu. Well, I was actually having that image, but I didn't know how to say that in English. So it's not like a rotating door. There's always someone passing through the rotating door. No. Again, we want to embrace this for eternity, not even for some years. Let's try to miserably manage to sustain our bhakti project and we are suffering like crazy. No, you want to susukam kartum, Krishna says in the Gita, to engage in this from a place of joy, gratefulness, bliss, and for eternity. So as I mentioned, radical personalism, our lifestyle should be so plausible that it has to be sustainable in eternity. If I'm already as a bhakta, I'm doing what I want to do forever, then I have to be practicing my bhakti in a way that feels nice to be practicing like that in eternity. You follow my point? But if I'm repressing and miserable and now, do I want that forever? I'm not sure. I'm not so sure. And if I say no, then the whole change begins here now. I cannot just practice this lifetime feeling miserable, just struggling after reaching a number and fitting in and compromising so much. And then magical thinking. When I leave my body, I go to Goloka Vrindavan and everything is working perfectly. No. You have to do your homework here. You are creating your Goloka Vrindavan here now. Vrindavan is a state of consciousness. What is your state of consciousness now? That's how you begin to create your Golok Vrindavan, so to say. Not saying that you create Golok Vrindavan, but your place there, if you will. And there's no place in Golok Vrindavan for people who are repressed or miserable or obsessed with vows and trying to compromise their identity to fit in. So we have to deal with all that stuff here now, which is a very valid, beautiful, heroic struggle. It is a struggle, but as at least we can acknowledge that and work on that. So, yeah. Again, I hope I don't sound that I'm criticizing ISKCON or criticizing people sharing the message, because to be honest, that's not my intention. It's just analyzing pros and cons of every model, so to say. Yeah, and addressing very, very obvious and realistic struggles that every practitioner, again, will have at one point of their journey. Like Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur clearly say, some chapter you will struggle keeping your vows. That will happen. It's part of the journey. So we better are equipped as a society or as a community or as a leader or as an individual to accompany others, knowing that that will happen and not like stigmatizing people when they are going through that. Or saying that shouldn't be happening. We cannot talk about it. Or because if not, we create a culture of superficiality. Just putting masks, religious masks, and we all know what's going on behind the mask, but nobody's talking about it. That's betraying the very purpose of what it means to be a devotee. Yeah, that's sad. I don't know if that
Yeah,
contributes in anything, Karuneshwari.
that helps so much because even though I've read, this, you've said those things before, even though I've read them before and I accepted them like theoretically, I think I was still carrying like some guilt. And somehow just now it must be like the, dynamic of the exchange. Like I sort of tangibly felt that shifting right now. So something just happened there, which was quite amazing.
We are having a live epiphany right straight from Karuneshvari's home. We are all part of that, bearing witness to it. Beautiful. Thank you. Yeah. And there are so many of those shifts, right? It's not like, okay, I had this shift and that's it. No, it's so many degrees of that. So yeah, transformation is ongoing. Thank you. Thank you for being willing for the transformation. Okay. I'm tempted to go to the breakout rooms, but also I'm tempted to invite Dibyangana to unmute herself. She has a question, and then we can go to a final breakout room so we don't get that late. I don't want to take too much of your time. Dibyangana is sending me a message. Okay. She's a little tired. Let me see what it says. I didn't see the whole message. Give me a moment. I'm not following the chat, sorry, simultaneously. Okay, she says that the question has been already answered. It happens sometimes, so I'm glad that's the case. Thank you for sharing that. So therefore, we can go to one more breakout rooms. If there is nothing else you would like to share, we have a few more minutes for some short sharing, question sharing. I'm not seeing any detailed raised hands. So yeah, we'll throw you into the breakthrough rooms. Hopefully you can have a breakthrough like Karuneshwari just had and continue discussing a little bit this particular situation, paradoxical situation of spreading the message, vows, rigidity in that, how to live those, whatever you want to share with each other, personal experiences, reflections. See you in a few minutes to put to rest our discussion today. Okay, there you are. Welcome back, you all. Hoping you have a inspiring connection between each other, continuing to gain awareness of and direct experience of, yeah, how important, how crucial it is to open ourselves to each other and enlighten one another, like Krishna says in the Gita, and it's giving our each other the offering, the gift of higher taste, a deeper perception, a deepened connection. So identity, purpose, and belonging can manifest in satsang. So see you next Saturday, same channel, same time. For you, same time. I'll be in Argentina actually next Saturday, so different time for me, but same time for you. And of those of you who connect to our Srimad Bhagavatam series, see you in 2 days. Thanks so much for your presence, the gift of your presence. Srimad Mahaprabhu Ki Jai, Sri Hari Nam Sankirtan Ki Jai, Gaur Bhaktavrinda Ki Jai, Gaur Premananda Hari 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 Bol.